Let's go, girls.
Welcome to the AmeriChicks with Kim Monson and Molly Vogt. Molly is a former mutual fund consultant and retirement plan specialist who is currently the director and founder of My Purse Politics. Kim served as a city councilwoman, is a former investment broker, and now a successful entrepreneur. Now, let's hear what's hatching in local and national politics with the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim.
Everybody, welcome to the AmeriChicks. I'm Molly.
And I'm Kim.
And we are super excited that it is Friday. It's our favorite day of the week because we get to honor World War II veterans.
It is a great day.
Yeah. Specifically, this guy is not just a World War II veteran, but also he fought during the Korean War and Vietnam. You're going to be impressed. So check us out. Give us a call if you want, 303-632-4160. We've got a lot of questions for this guy today. It's going to be a good one. We're KDMT, Denver's Money Talk, 1690 AM. And if you want information on us, you can follow us on our website and Facebook and Twitter, all as the AmeriChicks.
You got it.
So we'd love to hear from you. Let's not waste any more time, shall
okay.
we? Okay. So Kimmy and I had the great opportunity last year during D-Day to go to Normandy, France with four World War II vets. And it changed our lives. You know, once we heard real live personal stories from the greatest generation, we figured we want to hear them all. We want to hear as many as possible and get these on record so that the next generation knows the truth about the great sacrifices that America has always fought for everyone, for freedom, for the entire world. So we're going to start today with an amazing, amazing man, Colonel Douglas Dillard. This guy, military career spanned 35 years, three wars, the birth of modern special ops and military intelligence at its highest levels. Colonel Dillard, welcome to the AmeriChicks.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate it. Let's start with how you decided at the young age of 16 to join the war.
My stepfather had already deployed to North Africa for the initial invasion of U.S. forces in Europe. And we were living near Fort McPherson, Georgia, and I just couldn't wait. All the kids around the Fort McPherson, I wanted to go into the service, and I kept pestering my mother. And finally, she broke down and agreed to sign the paper. So on my 16th year of age, I was able to enlist, and the rather ironic thing is the sergeant major was an old friend of the family, so when I went to the recruiting office, he said, "Doug, I know you're not old enough, but since you love to sign the papers, I guess it's okay." So that's how it all started.
That's awesome. Now, your mom also joined.
Yes, she served for a few months in the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps, the WACS, and developed a back problem and had to be separated from the service because of that disability. And then she would just hang in there until my stepfather came back from Africa. And then by the time he came back, I was deployed overseas. So she had quite a time keeping up with the two of us.
Well, Colonel Dillard, this is Kim here, and as we were looking at a lot of the information, the other thing that's a bit astounding, the fact that you were 16 and your mother signed so that you could get into the service, is you were also an only child. As a mother, to sign for a 16-year-old to go to war as an only child, I mean, that really kind of took something from your mom.
I know it was a very difficult decision on her part, but I wouldn't give up. I just kept. And I've always had that attitude, is never give up, keep going.
Yeah. Well, you're a very patriotic family. We appreciate it. Let's talk about, you joined in 1942, you joined the Army, and you became a paratrooper.
Right.
Tell us about that very first jump. It was a very successful mission. Tell us about that jump and what you did.
Well, I attended a parachute school at Fort Benning, Georgia in November 1942, and complete the training and qualify and get your wings, you had to make five jumps there at Fort Benning. And today it was rather uneventful, all five jumps that were made during the week. We had no problems with the people that jumped with me and qualified. And the only thing that was distressing is, for some reason, on the the first jump, we had to, you jumped, recovered your parachute, loaded on the truck, and then in the evening, the same evening, you went back to the packing shed, and you packed your own parachute. Now, that changed a few months after that, and they developed riggers, but we had to pack our own chute. And we got in there and started to roll the chutes out on the packing tables, and the lights went out. And they said, well, by God, what are we going to do? We've got several hundred people here that need to qualify. And someone came up with a brilliant idea, so they opened the doors. They were big warehouse-type doors, and brought 2.5-ton trucks up with their lights on. So they shined their lights in the area there, and we packed our chutes for the next jump. So I've never forgotten that, and I was recently down at Fort Benning, and I was telling them the story, and I really don't think they believe me, but it's true.
Do a lot of things by candlelight. Okay, so you were 17 years old when you did your jump from the C-47 into southern France. Is it Operation Dragoon?
Correct.
Okay. And that was a very, very successful one. It looks like within 24 hours, you hit your goal. What was that?
Well, my unit was a separate parachute battalion. And in Italy, they fought. There were two separate battalions and one regimental combat team, a regiment and two battalions of paratroops. And they were formed into the 1st Airborne Task Force, which is the equivalent of a division. And that was the airborne force that dropped in on Operation Dragoon. And my battalion had a mission of setting up roadblocks, you know, securing the area and holding the area there until the forces landing on the beach could make contact with us within 72 hours. And that did happen. They were a little late making contact, but we were able to land, assemble, and I must say it was a little different for us because we each jumped with a landmine, and we had it in our jumpsuit pocket with the fuses wrapped in paper in another pocket. And after we were able to get assembled on the drop zone, the mines were all turned into supply so that we could to put out a better defense around the drop zone.
Hold on, Colonel Dillard. We're going to go to a break. We'll be right back and continue with your story. Stick with
Very
us.
Good.
Hey, if you like what you're hearing from the Americhicks, Molly and Kim, chances are your future clients do too. Let us help you promote your business and fatten up your wallet. To feature your business on the Americhicks program, email us at americhicks@gmail.com. We feature the most topical news and intriguing guests every weekday during afternoon drive time, 5 to 6 p.m., while you and your clients are enjoying the program on your way home from work. So become a sponsor today by emailing the Americhicks, Molly and Kim, at americhicks@gmail.com. That's the americhicks@gmail.com. Or visit us online at americhicks.com.
Home is where the heart is. It's that safe place where memories are made, meals shared, and holidays celebrated. When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you need to work with RE/MAX award-winning realtor Karen Levine. Karen Levine has helped individuals navigate the ups and downs of the Denver real estate market for over 28 years. Karen is honest, trustworthy, and has your best interests in mind. Karen takes the time to understand your unique wants and needs and can help you make the best decision for you and your family. Give Karen Levine a call at 303-877-7516 for a no-cost consultation or visit her online at karenlevine@remax.com. And tell her the Americhicks sent you. Every business needs great branding, an effective website, professional photography, and videos to promote their products and services. Normally, businesses have to find numerous providers to handle all this work while incurring substantial costs. That's where Desi On Demand comes in. You choose your budget, and you choose your services from Desi On Demand's menu. Kim Munson here. Molly and I heartily endorse the creativity, innovation, dedication, and integrity that Brand and the founder of Desi and his team bring to the table. Check out Desi On Demand's website at mydesi.com, that's D-E-Z-I, or call 303-359-1522 and tell them the Americhicks sent you.
It's complicated. Life, sometimes. Bookkeeping, sometimes. Taxes, all the stinking time. That's why you need to work with the proven professionals at Predovich & Company. They offer exceptional services to individuals, businesses, and nonprofits. Serving the South Metro area, the team at Predovich & Company takes a proactive approach in understanding your tax, accounting, and bookkeeping needs. Tax day's right around the corner, so call the pros at Predovich & Company today. 303-791-3000 or check out the website at dpredovich.com and be sure to tell them the Americhicks sent you.
Hey, welcome back. We're the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim, and we are, it's Friday, so it is World War II Friday. We are on 1690 KDMT, and we are talking with Colonel Douglas Dillard, 35-year combat veteran, served in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. But we're talking about him jumping August 15th, 1944, in Operation Dragoon, and he jumped into France with a landmine in your pocket. Did we hear that correctly, Colonel Dillard?
Yeah, we had the battalion had about 800 people in it, so practically everyone except the land tail that came in later by ship jumped with a landmine, and that was part of the effort to help defend the drop zone, you know, from any armor or other vehicles, tanks, that might try and penetrate our drop zone. And there were no problems with that because the fuses were taken out, and when we had wrapped them in paper very carefully and put them in another pocket so that there was not a danger of the mine exploding.
Oh, boy.
Wow.
You guys are real men, I'm just saying. Okay. So let's talk about, so within 24 hours of landing, you what were you able to accomplish?
Well, we made contact with the French resistance, and they told us the French in Draguignan, the larger town there that we were the final objective of the task force, that the French had started putting surrender flags out and French flags, and that the Germans were going to come back into the city, and there'd be a massacre, so we needed to get in the city right away. So our orders were changed. Rather than just defending the drop zone until contact was made with the beach forces, we then moved that evening through the line, through the German lines, into Draguignan to get on the high ground. And at the same time, the resistance told us where the division commander, Major General Beringer, who was the German commander, where his command post was. So two squads from A and B Company went to the villa and threw down the door with the bazooka around and went in, and the general was standing around the table with his staff. So within less than 24 hours, we captured the German commander, and we then learned that the lieutenant general, who's the corps commander, was in a bunker outside of Draguignan. So at daybreak, my company then went out to that area. We surrounded the bunker and fired a couple of bazooka rounds into what we thought through under the foliage there was the entrance to the bunker. And the general's aide came out, and he could speak English, and he said that the general knew that the area was surrounded and all that good stuff, but he had to surrender to another general. And we said, well, he's
not here right now.
issue, but anyway, we just garrisoned the area, secured it, and the next day, a division commander, assistant from the 36th Division that had come ashore, accepted his surrender. But I failed to mention that when the team went into General Beringer's villa there in Draguignan, the sergeant in charge took his pistol. So the general said, again, I must surrender to an officer. And there were no officers in the squad, so they called the company commander, B Company, is a Captain Evans, to come over and accept the surrender. So he came over there, and he came in, and the general, you know, through an interpreter, said, it's tradition, since we don't carry swords anymore, to present you with my pistol. But one of these ruffians has taken my pistol. And Captain Evans looked around and said, okay, guys, who's got the general's pistol? And everybody was totally silent. No one ever admitted it. I've got it here in my safe today. And one of these days I'll give it to probably the Army's National Museum here at Fort Belvoir.
Oh, that is awesome. That is awesome. Good stuff.
The impact that had is the command and control then was totally dismantled, and it facilitated 7th Army moving right on up the Rhone Valley to northern France. I mean, they had problems in Colmar Pocket, as many World War II veterans will certainly recognize, And that was considered kind of a second part of the Battle of the Bulge later on.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. You were very successful in everything you did. Tell us about the Battle of the Bulge. You did some rare bayonet attacks there. Is that correct?
Well, we did one. It was one of the few that was made during World War II, and we had been shot up the day before. My company commander had been wounded, and we lost two of our officers, so we had to move around on the flank. And as we were beginning to move forward, one element of A Company, this is my company, was moving ahead of the main body. We only had about two platoons and about, I guess, maybe 50 troopers left out of 105 that had shot up the first day. And Lieutenant Durkee, out the corner of his eye, caught movement in the woods off to our right flank. And they realized that the Germans had a trap set up, and they would be firing on the unit that was approaching them from the front, not knowing they were there. So Durkee just said, fix bayonets and charge. So the rest of A Company moved. We had to turn to our right and move directly into the German positions. And it was a rather mad moment for a while. In my case, I was carrying one of these cheap Charlie submachine guns that was frozen up and just stamped metal, the grease gun, as we called it. So I had to pull my pistol out and use it to fire into the mass of humanity. And I guess the event lasted maybe 5 minutes, if that long. And as soon as the last German was wounded or killed, Lieutenant Durkee, then I was acting as his assistant, he said, we got to get ready for the counterattack, because Germans, historically, when they lose ground, they turn around and counterattack within minutes. So we threw up our defenses. I got machine guns in position, and sure enough, the attack came, and we beat it off. And then the Germans, having been beaten away from our position, moved on down to the village of Russianval, which is the kind of the end of the story of my battalion, which we'll get to. But that's what happened, and we had a head count of somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 to 80 German bodies that were found in the area there after the attack.
Colonel Dillard, Kim here again. Tell me a bit about the Battle of the Bulge. I'm learning so much about this, but my understanding was that you guys didn't have the proper clothing, that instead of, you know, winter uniforms, that you didn't have things that really kept you warm. Were you part of that, or what did you see?
Well, you have to recall that my unit and the 517th Parachute Regiment and the 509 Battalion, we had just come up from southern France, and our uniform down there, the heaviest thing was just the wool shirt and slacks. And the logistics, you know, they used the Red Ball Express to haul stuff all the way from Normandy across France in trucks. And the supplies had not arrived. As a matter of fact, some of the people in the 101st Airborne were in the same problem. We were wearing summer uniforms. And some of the guys were still wearing their cotton jumpsuits. And the bulge just, on the night of 16 December, we got orders to get up and get ready, get loaded, get ready to go, get on trucks, do our basic load of ammunition, get our weapons ready, and we're going somewhere. And no one knew where we were going, because they said the report was the Germans had broken through the front and that we were going up to try and stop the penetration, but no one knew the destination. As it turned out, we were supposed to go to Bastogne. And as we entered the little village of Hotten, the SS Panzer unit had already cut that road. And we therefore, rather than going to the 101st, we were rerouted up to Verbevant and attached to the 82nd Airborne Division. And then we finished the bulge. You know, it was sub-zero weather. In some cases, the snow was almost waist deep.
Oh, my gosh.
Certainly knee deep. And we didn't have proper clothing, and we were out. We were not in any enclosure or anything during that whole period of time. It was strictly out in the forest there. And as a result, a lot of people ended up with frozen feet, extreme frostbite in the face, hands, and their and the frozen.
Well, and Colonel Dillard, it was. Am I correct in understanding that the skies, you know, the weather would not allow for any kind of a drop for a period of time, and then finally the skies opened up and you were able to get rations and get proper clothing, but it obviously was just really brutal.
Well, the overcast was really thick, and I remember one night the overcast, it didn't lift, but it was right down at ground level, and I remember seeing a German bomber. Right? It was maybe a just one of their light fighter bombers came very low and flew under that overcast and then out, but our aircraft did not do any flying until, and I believe I may be correct about this, until Christmas Day. And on Christmas Day, the sky was covered with B-17 bombers. It was like a movie.
Beautiful.
And as they flew towards the German lines, the Germans put up their anti-aircraft, and it looked like neon signs going off up in the air. And every now and then you'd see one of the bombers explode or get hit and start falling, and the airmen parachuting out. And I just never forget that. And I see some of these movies where they have air support, and I remember that day and how impressed I was with the guys that were flying those B-17s, and they held their formation and headed right into that wall of flak, and many of them were killed. A lot of people don't realize it, but there were over 20,000 airmen killed in Europe during World War II.
Well, and actually we had Major Frederick Arnold on. He was a P-38 pilot. And he had has done this sculpture that's going to be down at the World War II Museum, and he dedicated it to the 88,000 airmen that were killed in World War II, which is just astounding. So
yeah, it really is. Yeah.
Now, and I mean the human toll is significant. But on January 4th, if I looked at this correctly, that was that bayonet charge that
Molly had mentioned.
But then by January 8th, out of your 800 members of your 551st, is it your parachute battalion?
Right.
You only had 14 officers left and 96 enlisted men. But that unit did get the presidential unit citation, but that's a significant amount of human life.
Yeah, the battalion was really destroyed. See, our zone of attack was down. It was not in the – they had been in the forest, the dense Ardennes. But as we broke out on that hill mast leading down to the Somme River, there was totally clear terrain. And the German artillery observers across the Somme River from the near Vigny, they had clear sight of all of our movements. So the artillery was very accurate. So we had a lot of casualties from artillery.
Colonel Dillard, hang on with us if you don't mind. We're going to just go to a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Molly with the AmeriChicks. My friend Susan owns the longest-standing drive-in movie theater in Denver, 88 Drive-In. And it is that time again to open the gates for the 41st season this April 14th. Join them. Spend a beautiful evening under the stars, in the privacy of your car, or sitting on lawn chairs. Share buttery drive-in popcorn and other goodies with your family and friends. Admission's only $8 per person, and children under 12 are free. You cannot beat that one. For the most up-to-date information, like the 88 Drive-In on Facebook or visit the website 88drivein.com.
Okay. Welcome back. We are the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim. We are talking with Colonel Douglas Dillard. We're talking about his experience in World War II. We're at the Battle of the Bulge right now, and he is there. We're at the point where we're seeing the B-17s. The skies have cleared. The B-17s are coming in. You said it was quite a sight. So where do we take it from there, Colonel Dillard?
Well, we moved into a bivouac or billeting area, dug in foxholes, and on the 27th of December, we were in the reserve for the 30th Infantry Division for a couple of days because they had committed. So a lot of people don't realize it, but the northern shoulder, as we refer to it, is where the, I think it was the 99th, the 30th Infantry, and 82nd was holding the line up there and actually stopped the 6th Panzer Army Group that was the main force headed towards Antwerp. And I think quite often that's neglected. Nobody thinks, well, if you were in, that you were only in Bastogne. Well, Bastogne wasn't the name of the game. I mean, it had a great significance, but it wasn't the only thing going there. But General Gavin, the commander of the 82nd, gave us an order to do a full battalion reconnaissance in force through the lines of the 1st SS and 9th SS Panzer Division defenses to collect intelligence. What we didn't know is that the 3rd of January had been the date selected for the big American counterattack to clear all German forces west of the Somme River. And our mission was to go out, test the defenses to see what they're going to be up against on the 3rd. So that night,
I just have to ask you, how do you do that? I mean, what do you do to try to find out all that information?
Well, we had to first penetrate their lines, and there was a small firefight with a few. We had a few people wounded, but nothing really big deal, and killed several Germans on their outposts, and engaged in a continuous firefight up to the, I guess about 4,000 meters behind German lines. We captured a unit commander and several of the prisoners, and destroyed a headquarters. And we crossed the line around midnight, between midnight and 1 o'clock in the morning, and got in, engaged in that firefight and the capture of prisoners. And we came back through the lines just before daylight. And General Gavin was there at the outpost, so you guys did a good job. And I think that we did, because it provided some good information, including, the interrogation of that company commander, German, about the defenses and the morale and attitude of the German defenders. So we felt very happy about that. And, of course, we went back into our areas of division reserve, and then on the 3rd of January is when the big counterattack started.
Okay.
All right. Well, tell us, is there anything else you want to talk about World War II to let our listeners know in the, before we move on to Korea?
Well, what was not mentioned is the fact that on the 7th, while we were doing the attack in A Company, we ran into a nest of machine guns, which we were not anticipating that. And down there, everybody, I think we had 7 people left in A Company. And one of the men received the Distinguished Service Cross for that, but the unit then was inactivated in the field because the airborne units were really shot. They just come out of Holland. We were licking their wounds, but when they were committed to the bulge, and they didn't have replacements, so they were. Decision was made somewhere along the line to deactivate the separate units like our battalions, and reassign whoever was left to regiments in the 82nd. And I ended up, I was reassigned to finish the war with C Company of the 508 Parachute Regiment. And I had the great honor of replacing the first sergeant of C Company was Leonard Funk, the Medal of Honor winner from the Ardennes action. And when he rotated to come home, I replaced him as first sergeant of C Company. And that was, to me, a very distinct honor to replace that guy. He was a real good soldier. And the other thing is that the 82nd then was pulled off the line and rested for a couple of 3 weeks, and then went back in the line up with the 21st Army Group under Montgomery. And our division crossed the Elbe River, liberated the Böblen concentration camp, was full of Hungarian Jews, and met up with the Russians on the Elbe River. And, we crossed it, so we had to go back across the Elbe, get on the west side of it. But we had a really remarkable day there in meeting the Russians. So that's sort of the end of the combat part, because our regiment then was sent to Eisenhower's headquarters. It was moving from Reims to Frankfurt, Germany, And our regiment then was pulled from the 82nd to go in and provide internal and external security for General Eisenhower's staff and the general officers that were billeted around in the different villas around the Frankfurt area.
Okay. Colonel Dillard, just a question. When you liberated that concentration camp, were you involved in that? I mean, do you have any comments or stories about that that you'd like to share?
Well, the 327th was the one, the regiment, the personnel from it that actually went into the camp and saw it firsthand, the first few days. But General Gavin then wanted the troops to see it, so the troops were paraded through the camp to get firsthand view of it, and then General Gavin ordered that the bodies be picked up by the local Germans from around the Ludwigslust, which is the largest city there. Vogelin is just outside of Ludwigslust. And the graves, there's a mass grave dug right in the gardens of the castle there in Ludwigslust. And the German citizens then had to take the bodies there. It was about a 4-kilometer walk. And they were all interred in the garden of that castle by the German civilians. And our troops were all very, we weren't happy, but we were victorious. And we saw that was an honorable thing to do.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Tough to see that kind of thing. But
as a matter of fact, I was there for a reunion 2 years ago. And a gentleman came up and said, "Are you Colonel Dillard?" And I said, "Yep." And he said, "Well, I'm Rabbi Berkowitz from Falls Church, Virginia. And I'm glad to meet you." And I said, "Well, now, what's your story?" And he said, "I was 17 years old in this camp when you guys came in. And here's a survivor living in my backyard almost in Virginia since I live in Maryland. And I never knew that, and we immediately became, very, very good friends. And I think he's got one of the largest synagogues in Northern Virginia."
Wow, that's quite a story, Colonel Dillard.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
We're definitely going to want to talk to him.
Yeah.
For sure. Let's move on to Korea, because your service in Korea remained classified until 1990. And looks like you were the Director of Human Intelligence and Collection Requirements for the Defense Intelligence Agency. You were one of the founding fathers of the Special Operations and one of the original members and leaders of the of Delta Force. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, I have to correct the latter part. I was never really involved in Delta Force. When I was in the 80s, after the war, I was reassigned. I spent a couple of years in the Georgia Military District, reorganizing the reserve units, and I was running the sergeant major for the 108th Airborne Division Reserve. And from that, I was ordered back to the 82nd, and then the Korean War broke out, and I was ordered on active duty then as a second lieutenant and deployed to Korea. And another friend of mine, as a matter of fact, Sergeant Albritton, who had taken the German general's pistol, he and I were on the same orders. We were still in the 82nd. We both went to Korea together. And one of his childhood friends was a lieutenant colonel then that had been with the 7th Division. And when we arrived in Japan, he called him, Lieutenant Albritton then was a lieutenant, and he invited us down to Tokyo for dinner. And he said, "You guys might be interested in this new unit that is being fleshed out. And your combat infantry, your airborne, they need people like that." So he said, "That's all I can tell you." So we said, "Okay, we'll go with that." So we were assigned to the 500th Military Intelligence Group and put on a plane and sent to Korea. So arrived and reported in.
Colonel Dillard, hold that thought. We need to go to break and we'll come right back, okay?
Okay.
Go
Guy Whiddon, 101st Airborne, landed Normandy in the dark on D-Day 1944, was knocked out on the jump, woke up, a gun to his head. What happened next? If you love the AmeriChicks World War II project on Fridays and know a World War II vet, we'd love to share their story. We're in a race against time to gather as many stories as possible and as quickly as possible to preserve them for all future generations. So if you know a World War II vet or have that great World War II story to share, email us at AmeriChicks@gmail.com. That's the AmeriChicks@gmail.com.
Hey, if you like what you're hearing from the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim, chances are your future clients do too. Let us help you promote your business and fatten up your wallet. To feature your business on the AmeriChicks program, email us at AmeriChicks@gmail.com. We feature the most topical news and intriguing guests every weekday during afternoon drive time, 5 to 6 p.m., while you and your clients are enjoying the program on your way home from work. So become a sponsor today by emailing the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim, at AmeriChicks@gmail.com. That's the AmeriChicks@gmail.com. Or visit us online at AmeriChicks.com.
Hey, welcome back to the AmeriChicks Radio Show with Molly and Kim. We are KDMT, Denver's Money Talk. If you have a question, 303-632-4160. But I don't know if you're going to have much time to get it in. We're only in Korea War right now. So we are talking with Colonel Douglas Dillard, and his career spans 35 years and three different wars. So we went through World War II, and I cannot believe you jumped out of a perfectly good airplane with landmines in your pocket. But now we're moving on to Korea. So you're in Korea. You're down in Tokyo. And they said because of your paratrooper experience, your combat experience, they've got some new stuff they're going to do, and they thought maybe you'd be good for it. So what were they describing? What was the new idea?
Well, I reported into what was known as the 8240th Army Unit, and it was the clandestine operating unit in Korea at that time. And I was assigned to the Special Air Missions Unit, and what we did was we trained and qualified for jumping Korean agents and Chinese. We did have some Chinese agents, and I would then take them out during the moon phase and drop them in different areas around North Korea and southern Manchuria. And we used B-26 planes, seaplanes, C-47s, C-46s, and different situations, different numbers of teams or partisan forces. And during that period of the year that I was there, I lost one plane because a Chinese agent had managed to get into our system, and the agent, as he jumped out of the plane, he threw a grenade back in, and it blew up the plane. And fortunately, my two jump masters were able to clear it. They were standing in the door and were blown out of the plane when the grenade went off, and they survived, although we don't know what happened to one of them. We were told by agents that one of them had been turned over to a Russian officer and one son, but we could never prove that. And during a break, where one of the team leaders up with the 1st Marine Division, he extended his tour and took a short leave. And my colonel asked me if I'd go up and take over his frontline team. I said, sure, no problem. And it was what we call a TLO, or Tactical Liaison Office, and we had a cadre of agents. In this case, they were former North Korean agents. I mean, North Koreans that we had made into agents. And we would take them through the outpost line in behind the Chinese lines and release them, and they'd go and collect information, tactical information. And they would come back and meet us at a prearranged place, and we would work with the outpost line to get back into our line so that our frontline troops didn't shoot us. And I did that for about 2 months in the summer, and then went back and took over the Special Air Mission team until I rotated in December. And that was a very, very hairy experience, I would say.
You say that so calmly, but I bet it was. Oh my gosh!
Well, we had lots of good. I was able to get the Distinguished Service Cross awarded to one of the troopers, and a Silver Star for one of the others on one of the operations, and then there were various awards made for different people.
Hmm. All right. So then in 1967, you were sent to Vietnam. Talk to us about your time there.
Well, I was supposed to go as an intelligence officer for one of the infantry divisions. And when I arrived in Saigon, they looked at my record and said, "We're revamping the Phoenix program, and if you've read any and hear about it, it got a real bad name when it first started." And they said, "We need you more than going to an infantry division headquarters." So I ended up in the Mekong Delta and worked from the 4th Corps Tactical Zone. General Eberhardt was the senior advisor there, but I worked primarily with a national agency that was responsible for the Phoenix program. And I had about 105 military intelligence officers that I didn't have a command of them, but I did have staff supervision, which meant to go around and tell them what to do, how to do it. And the program first started, and it was to root out the Viet Cong infrastructure. That was its main and only task. And I worked very closely with the South Korean Special Police Branch in this intelligence cycle to locate the people. But initially, there were people settling old scores. And I'm talking now not about U.S., but Vietnamese. And it may be a tribal thing or a village thing, but they'd go out and accuse somebody of being a Viet Cong and kill them. And we had to overcome that. So I told my officers that I would be visiting you. I spent every day in the field with my counterpart, Colonel Fouque, who crashed in the Bassi River in a helicopter and was killed a month after I left. But while he got his people together, I would get all the Americans together. There was usually one to five people in the team out in the district. And I told them, if I ever find out you're involved in any torture of these prisoners or their death, I'll be sure that you're court-martialed. And the importance was I tried to emphasize both with my men and the Vietnamese, a dead Viet Cong doesn't do us any good, except we have reduced the numbers, but we don't have any information from them. And our key thing here is to either capture or defect a Viet Cong's actual Viet Cong or a sympathizer, so we can get the information from him how we can go after others. But a dead one is not going to help us that much. And Colonel Fouque and I were out every day. If I never see another helicopter, it'll be too soon, because I detest being around them anymore, because I was in one every day. And had some weird stories about that. That's just another thing. But I thought we ran a good program. And at the time that I left to come home, we found out that we had been so effective. And I was in the Mekong Delta down in Canto, where 40% of the population is located in South Vietnam. And we had reduced the Viet Cong ranks so badly that they weren't able to recruit locally, and they had to start sending more North Vietnamese down to run their Viet Cong or their secret guerrilla program. So I felt that I had made a contribution, even though that war was so unpopular. I mean, I was there and I did my duty, and I'm not ashamed of any of it. And I wanted to be sure that we observed the right rules of warfare, and we had a chance to capture someone, that's exactly what we did. We captured them, turned them over to the South Vietnamese Army for interrogation.
Well, go ahead, Molly. Do you have another question?
Well, I was just going to ask, we've only got a couple more minutes left. So when you completed your second year tour there, then you moved on to the 500th Military Intelligence Group. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the 500th group had responsibility for Army intelligence collection and counterintelligence work throughout the Pacific. So I had elements in Japan, Korea, Okinawa, Thailand, the Philippines, and trips in and out of Cambodia and Laos. So it kept me very busy. I was on the road most, actually it's the equivalent of a second tour in Vietnam, and all the counterparts that I had to deal with. And the main thing that I enjoyed, but it was being exposed to all the different cultures and being able to understand how to work and deal and coordinate with my counterparts, even though their cultures were a little different from each other. They were different from anything that I had ever been exposed to. So I had to quite often eat things that I would never have even thought of eating and drink probably a little more scotch than I ever wanted.
All right. Okay. Now tell us just real quick, because we're about run out of time, but Colonel Douglas Dillard, you have written some books. How can people, you know, find your books and order them just to support you and find out a little information that you shared?
Well, the main book is the Tiger Hunters, and it's a story of what I've just been talking about, the Korean Special Operations. And it would be available. I think you could order it through Amazon and eBay. Or I know that some people have done that. And if anyone is really interested, they can contact me, or I don't know how you want to do that. But
well, if anybody wants to contact you, they could just contact us. So go to the AmeriChicks Facebook page or our website or something like that. Let us know, and if you want, then we'll get it. We can kind of help funnel people your way.
Or they can go to a bookstore and they could order it for them.
Yeah, the Tiger's Hunters.
We're having a seminar here in April about the Korean War. It's too, and we have the ambassador from Belgium and Luxembourg attending, as well as several other dignitaries. And we're hoping that we'll get someone from the White House. That's the end of last week of April here in Springfield, Virginia.
Awesome. Okay, well, Colonel Dillard, 35-year combat veteran, overseas service bars lined up to his elbow, as an Iraqi veteran has described it. Thank you so much for your service. We really appreciate everything that you've done for liberty and freedom for all.
Yeah.
Enjoy talking to you guys, and I'm still fighting. I still have four daughters to contend with.
Well, yeah, it sounds like you've got four daughters, seven grandchildren, and eight grandchildren. Great. Yeah, so you've got a lot. So thanks so much. We appreciate you. God bless.
You. Right.
Thank you.
Right.
Well, Molly, that was really an honor to get to talk with Colonel Douglas Dillard. And there is an excellent piece that I think that you either shared or we will hear in just we'll share a little bit later. But this is by Don Johnston, Rob Swain, and Anthony Lopresti. And they had done an interview with Colonel Dillard. And it's titled Douglas Dillard, A Soldier's Soldier, A Real Man. And it is it's really inspirational. And so we'll get that up on our Facebook. But the very last thing that they said about him, I thought was amazing. He said, in the short time I was able to speak with Colonel Dillard, he emulated what a true leader is and what a man should be. He's a soldier's soldier, a real man.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Well, this is the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim signing off. Y'all have an excellent weekend, and we'll talk to you next Monday.
Can be so rough, can be so